Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Dr. Zed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care, and he's the director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Dr. Miller welcomes Dr. Bernie Siegel, the author of several books focused on spiritual healing, including the best-selling Love, Medicine, and Miracles.
You were a surgeon. You practiced for how many years? And how did you get into writing?
I've got to tell you this interesting story. I went to Colgate University, and as a science major, living in my head, I took a course, Creative Writing. And I got a C. That's the only C in 4 years of college. I've asked the college to raise the grade because of what I've done, and they refuse because I wouldn't get high honors if they gave me a B. But the difference was, I think in those days, I was living in my head, not at my heart. And I think what explains it best is a story from William Saroyan. He has a man who's a writer, and a young man is helping him. They're in the army, and they're writing about the war. And the writer comes in the office one day and says to the kid, "Hey, you're a really good writer." And the kid says, "What are you talking about? I haven't written anything." He says, "Oh, no, what's on your desk?" He said, "That's a letter to my father." And the writer says, "All right, then write a letter to everyone." And I think that's what I tend to do now. You know, I'm coming from my heart. I'm writing about my feelings to everyone. And so, yeah, I started writing a book. It wasn't my idea. People said to me, "Do you ever think of writing a book?" I said, "Hey, maybe that'll save me time and trouble," because I was talking to so many people.
Sure.
I found out it makes life harder if you write a book, because then everybody wants to talk to you. And I don't mean harder in a difficult, way, but just everybody wants contact. And so, yeah, I literally talked into a tape recorder and then had somebody edit it and make it into a book. Now, I can write now because, again, it's coming from my feelings and experience and not about what are you thinking about.
Bernie, you did a lot of cancer surgery during your career. And when and where was the transition between, you know, being a surgeon who's primarily focused on operating and taking out tumors to really being a healer?
I didn't realize that my problem is that I like people. You know, I went into medicine, you might say, for the wrong reasons. That there are a lot of kids who do it because the human body fascinates them.
Sure.
And then they get into trouble because people show up. But I like people, and I realized, but you can't cure and fix everything. As a medical student, I used to pray over sick kids in the dark and be totally embarrassed if anybody found me in there. And they'd say, "What are you doing in this room in the dark?" And I never said, "Well, I'm praying for this kid. I don't know why God would do this." And what was interesting, Carl Simonton came to Connecticut back, I think, in 77. He was doing work on imagery and cancer and the title of the talk, I thought, was just for doctors, you know, about cancer. And so I signed up for it. I thought maybe I have something more to offer patients. When I got there, there were literally about 125 people there. Three of them were doctors. The other two were psychotherapists, basically, and I was a surgeon sitting there. But who's in the room? All my patients. And the one who literally transformed my life was the one who said to me, "You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits." That's when I thought, okay, you know, what are we taught? Death is, they're failing. So I could stop being a failure. I could help people live. And that's when, again, I learned. I sent 100 letters to our patients with cancer. It blew my mind, saying, "You want to live a longer, better life, come to a meeting."
How many came?
Me expecting 300 to 500. I was a total wreck, saying, "You jerk, you didn't write, don't bring friends and family." And less than a dozen women appeared. And I realized, I don't know the people I'm taking care of. And that's when I began to talk to them about their lives. And some actually said to me, "Yes, I'd like to die if you'll just make it comfortable." For me, the cancer's a way out. And I mean, there's just so many things I heard. And the other side of the coin was you begin to realize that when you go out lecturing to schools, you know, synagogues, churches, patients I thought were dead came up to say hello. And it's like, wait a minute. And I'd pull their charts, and everybody dead in 2 months, dead in six. You know, it's like, well, why the hell go back? But they all had stories to tell about lifetime transformations. And so I began to put together things to try to share with people so you didn't die when you were supposed to, you know, kind of what would help them be survivors.
Well, so, you know, along those lines, I remember you lecturing and talking about how doctors write prescriptions.
Yeah.
And one of the prescriptions, you know, someone will say, well, doctor, how long do I have? And the doctor says, well, you've got 6 months. Mm-hmm. So well, yeah. What are your thoughts on that now? You know,
well, it kills.
Yeah.
It literally does. I mean, one of the things I also realized from studying communication that we're not taught how to talk to people. Mm-hmm. So one of our kids, and I don't think this was an accident, you know, it's like higher consciousness. He wrote the word words on a canvas as an art project at school, but leaving no space between the word words. And you know what? They become swords.
Mm-hmm.
You write words, 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 words.
And swords.
And I thought, wow. So I can kill a cure with words, kill a cure with a scalpel.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interesting thing is this is not a part of medicine, that I wrote articles for medical journals. They all came back saying it's interesting, but it's inappropriate. Okay. So I sent it to where it was appropriate. They came back again, but this time it said it's appropriate, but it's not interesting. See, they were saying, we know this.
Yeah.
And those were psychotherapeutic journals.
Sure.
And I always remember Carl Menninger. I got a wonderful letter from him because he wrote, he said, I was about to write a book called 12 Hopeless Cases. These are 12 people who are supposed to be dead who are all walking around fine today, but you've written the book, so I'm not. You know?
And it's a nice story.
When you read his work and other psychiatrists, The Will to Live by Hutchinecker, mm-hmm. I mean, these are people who saw, you know, Larry LaShawn, the psychologist, You Can Fight for Your Life, you know, people who helped others transform their life and suddenly, you know, they didn't die. And it's taken me all these years to realize this is the age-old message, you know, be born again.
Mm-hmm.
See, and I get back to science. I mean, it's genetic. Bacteria, viruses, plants alter their genes to survive. And it's intelligent. I mean, it's not a chance. It happens too quickly. I always say we have a hell of a lot more complicated life than a bacteria. But
true.
I think when we have a disease disappear, it's because we make a genetic alteration. And what I found fascinating was Solzhenitsyn in his book Cancer Ward. Again, he's a native. He's been there. He's had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't have the men saying, oh, there are miracles and spontaneous remissions. The man says, oh, I found this medical book. It says here there are cases of self-induced healing, not recovery through treatment, but actual healing. Wow. And the symbol of it, he says, it was like a rainbow-colored butterfly fluttered out of the great open book. And I thought, he said everything we need to know. The butterfly is about transformation. The rainbow is your life in order.
Mm-hmm.
So get your life in order, transform yourself.
And
look
it's like
what can happen.
And it's
yeah.
like a butterfly.
Yeah.
One of the concepts that you've talked about for many years is the exceptional cancer patient. So a two-part question, Bernie. Who is the exceptional cancer patient? And for you as a doctor and as a person, what have you learned from exceptional cancer patients?
Well, first of all, my wife came up with the name because I said, I don't know what to call the organization or these people. She said, they're exceptional. The ones who showed up. Mm-hmm. I said, fine, we'll call it. And it became ECAP, you know.
Yeah.
Because I was looking for words like hope and heal, you know, to play with letters.
Sure.
But again, what I found was, see, I brought up by parents who loved me. I did well in school. And my grandfather was my religious teacher. So I didn't have trouble with God. I'm a minority figure. And I didn't know that till I began this work because you know, when you say, people say, oh, I'm not exceptional. And I realize the wounds from their parents, educators, religions, I mean, they're afraid to take on a challenge. So I'd say the exceptional patients were willing to take on a challenge, to find coaching and guidance and transform their lives. And most of these have the talent. They have what I call the inspiration, but you got to give them the information, put it together, some wonderful things happen.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones who have brought up, quote, my mother's words were eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer. She only dressed me in dark clothes and told me I'm a failure. Yeah. And so that's why I've even written books about parenting, when I realize how these wounds are hypnotic. And I also began to study people like Milton Erickson, psychiatrist, hypnotherapist, who as a child had polio. And he heard a doctor in the hallway say to his mother, he's not going to see the sun come up. See, he got angry. Mm-hmm. He was exceptional. He said, I'm going to watch the sun come up. You know, he didn't say, oh, I'll die at 2 a.m. Sure. Yeah, because of what the doctor said. So he knew how to talk to patients. I mean, and think of this. This is one of his simple things. And he would talk in terms of stories, you know, about surviving and other things. But you sit in your office. Say you have cancer. You're sitting in the office. Doctor writes down something and then says, excuse me, I have to use the bathroom or there's a phone call I have to answer, and walks out. What do?
You read it. You read the paper, sure.
And he would write, doing well, and walk out. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And wow, what an impact. You know,
sure
he comes back and you're sitting there thinking, I'm doing well. And you go home with a different attitude. So I used to work at deceiving people into health. I'd lie to them, you know. I realize it's not as effective because they didn't want to get sued.
Sure.
So I would say to the family, I'm lying, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's got extensive cancer. I mm-hmm. probably can't cure it, but yeah. I'm not going to tell him that. See, and we'd have him come in the office every couple of weeks, give him a good painful shot, mm-hmm. talk for a while, you know, and then let him go home. And I watched people literally live often for years in you know, not getting any specific treatment,
sure.
but doing something that made them have hope.
You know, I remember the story about you had a man with stomach cancer, gastric
yeah.
cancer.
Yeah, John.
Yeah, who showed back up in the office yeah. 10 years later. And
yeah, it was 4 years later. He refused treatment. I always say, thank God it was springtime because he was a landscaper. And he said, I'm going home to make the world beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing I always mention. They don't deny their mortality. People say, I gave away my treasures. I made out a will. Then I started doing what I love to do. And John went home to make the world beautiful. He refused chemotherapy and radiation. And 4 years later, he came back saying, I have a hernia from lifting boulders in my landscape business. He died at 92. And I literally gave a talk at his 70th wedding anniversary because I said, I got to tell the world what this man is like and what he taught me, you know, about the world and how beautiful it was.
Let me ask a question then about truth-telling, because there's always a fine line between
yeah.
laying it all out and on the other hand, and not. So,
but you see, I don't use statistics as the truth.
Right.
I mean, for me, statistics help me decide what therapy, you know, so if more people live doing this, then mm-hmm. let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife has breast cancer. Yes, she's had surgery. She's on medication. But, you know, I also look at, they might, if people had suggested some things to me, I might have said, no, thank you. That may change the quality of my life. I don't want to do that. So I call life a labor pain.
Mm-hmm.
What are you willing to experience? Well, this is the end of a poem a lady wrote, comparing 9 months of pregnancy to 12 months of chemotherapy and radiation. One is worthwhile you give birth to your child. The other is worthwhile you give birth to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So what I found was if I help people make the right decisions, they had fewer side effects. And that I also see with the drawings. That when you say to somebody, draw yourself getting chemotherapy, and they draw the devil giving them poison, you got a problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But when they draw it as a gift from God, and some people literally do that, they don't have the side effects that everybody else is having.
It's true. And I, you know, when I talk to people about chemotherapy, I try to send a positive message. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I'll say, you know, I want you every morning when you wake up and you take maybe a pill to say to yourself, you know what, this is good. This
yeah.
is really.
Because I put what people are given when they get the drug Adriamycin in one of my books. Because, see, if you think of Erickson trying to help people, what does it say when you're going to give Adriamycin? It's like the ads on television. You know, you can take this, and then they speak as fast as they can, but it can make your hair fall out, drop dead, you know, have a, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole page is what can go wrong if you take it. It would be nice if they put a sentence in saying this drug is helpful in the treatment of, there are side effects associated with it. You see, right now you're shaking your head yes, as you agree with me.
I do.
So when you read Adriamycin and what goes wrong, you start shaking your head no.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody says and it'll help you, your reaction is still a negative one. No, it isn't. But if they had started out with this is helpful, oh, good, you know, and your head is nodding, then you don't have the side effects because you're saying, no, it's going to be good for me.
It's going to help me. Well, we'd like to remind you, our listeners, please email your questions to canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more about the art of healing with Dr. Bernie Siegel.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that when you detect it early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means that if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients who develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before, thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with Dr. Bernie Siegel, a very well-known physician and author of several books on healing and on spirituality and also on parenting. So Bernie, let me ask you about that first in this segment, parenting and cancer. I mean, on one hand, they sound different, but how are they the same?
Well, I mean, two things. I get criticism. Somebody showed me that there was an article recently in the New York Times still criticizing me. But it's misinterpreting. You know, it's what people project on me. Carolyn Thomas, psychiatrist down at Johns Hopkins years ago, had the medical students fill out a form, personality profile, and draw a picture of themselves. Her statement was, because I talked to her, she said, I could tell who's going to get what disease by how they drew themselves. The cancer patients were more often their arms in different positions. They were ambivalent. Mm-hmm. Like heart attacks were wide open arms, you know, making you vulnerable. But anyway, but she also said the cancer patients had a low closeness to parent profile. And she said from the drawings, I could tell where they were going to get cancer.
Mm-hmm. Hey.
Now, she didn't all of that public, if you know what I mean.
It's
a lot of that
scary.
Was on the phone. Yeah. And the other thing, the study at Harvard, while the students were, you know, at the college, they were asked, did your parents love you? Those who said yes, 35 years later, about 1 out of 4 had suffered a major illness. Those who said no, over 90%. Hmm. And in the book, Biology of Belief by Bruce Lipton, he's a geneticist. He makes it very clear that children's brains up to the age of 6 have a brainwave pattern of a hypnotized individual. So what your parents are saying to you is totally destructive. And I always say that people who are drug addicts, well, just read the headlines now. You know, this 15-year-old who kills his parents and his siblings. I mean, that's about rejection. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's the opposite of love is indifference. So you want to get attention? Then the guilt, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised he didn't commit suicide along with them.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's these the history. So I always say information is not what the problem is. In other words, if you're a drug addict, you're smoking 2 packs a day, you weigh 400 pounds, mm-hmm. I mean, you never exercise. That is not stupidity. That's lack of inspiration, lack of self-esteem and love. And I found with my patients that you see, what do most doctors do when you come in? Light up a cigarette under a sign that says no smoking and don't fill your prescription. What's the point of coming back?
Sure.
No more appointments. Oh, see, you don't care about me just like my parents. Mm. I would always say, see you next week. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a hug before you go. 6 months later, there was one woman, literally, I had to change my jacket when I hugged her. I mean, I don't think she took a bath in a year. And her husband was an abusive, you know, alcoholic. She came in one day looking wonderful, telling me she's gotten a job, gotten her husband out of the house. Why? Because this guy said to her, I care about you, and I persisted. So she, I think, realized one day, you know, I'm worth something. I've done this with 1,000, it was something like 1,600 high school students. I stood on the platform, said to all of them, I want you to know I love you. If you need a father, you got one. Here's my phone number. Here's my email address. It's called The Chosen Dad that a suicidal kid gave me, called me her CD, which is what that stood for. Yeah. But see, you'd say, how can you do that? The kid? No, they now know somebody loves them. I got 3 phone calls, you know, or emails.
Yeah. And I bet they
because they went home saying,
there was a reason.
Hey, He cares. Mm-hmm. We must be, you know, worth something. I don't need to call him up. Yeah.
So let me ask you, how for physicians, for and for people that are treating patients with cancer, and for those that are exceptional cancer patients, what can we do to make that interaction more meaningful? That we can, that I as a doctor can be a more help to my patients, that my patients can get more help from me.
I think it's being human on both sides. I mean, I literally was going to become a veterinarian because of the pain of being a doctor. Except one of my patients was a veterinarian. So I said to him, I need guidance. He said, don't change. I said, why not? He said, people bring the pets in. And he helped me to focus on the people. That doesn't mean you don't focus on yourself. See, that was the other thing. When I painted a self-portrait, when the family and our pets got tired of sitting for me, I painted myself in a cap, mask, and gown, hidden. Now, I didn't know how sick that painting was until a couple of years later when I look at it and I think, how the hell could you paint yourself totally covered up? Well, I'm in pain. Mm-hmm. Oh, I drew a picture for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross one day because she became my teacher too. And she said, what are you hiding? What are you covering up? I said, what are you talking about? She said, you drew a mountain with snow on it. I said, yeah, it's snow. She said, the page is white. You don't need a white crayon. You've added a layer. And then I started talking to her about my feelings and pain. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think she helped me too. That if, see, I used to say to patients, I need to hug you. I didn't hear the first two words were, I need. Mm-hmm. And when I began to realize this, I started saying to patients, I want to thank you. Oh, we knew you were in pain. We knew you needed help. Alan Merman, you know, the former pediatrician in Guilford, went to Yale, became a minister, becomes the chaplain at Yale. It was great while he was there because I did a lot of things with him. He asked every surgeon, how does it feel to be a surgeon? And he published this article. He said, everybody answers, I think. No, I asked you how you felt. Uh-huh. I think I'm telling you. He said 3 to 5 times, you know, you repeated it. And they finally said, oh, you want to know how I feel? Uh-huh. Yes. And that's when the pain, say, I don't want to get close to my patients. They die. It hurts more. But. Yeah, and these are things we never discuss in any conferences. I'm proud to say 11 years after I wrote to the American College of Surgeons about dealing with feelings, because here's a sick line from the pledge if you're a surgeon. Mm. The second line, I will deal with my patients as I would wish to be dealt with if I were in the patient's position.
Bernie, if you rewrote it today.
Yeah, I wrote them. I said, I will care for my patients. Yeah. And they said, oh, you want to write an article? And then it took them a long time to publish my article. And the painting I just described to you, see, I stood in front of that so you'd see the two people at the end of the article. They cut that out. Mm-hmm. All you see is my beaming, you know, smiling face. They couldn't deal with it. 11 years later, the American College of Surgeons has finally had meetings on end-of-life issues. And boy, I just called up and to the people sponsoring it to say, mm-hmm. Bless you, and if I can help, let me know. Yeah.
How do you use meditation and dreams to sort of understand people better?
Again, you know, Carl Jung, 80 or so years ago, interpreted a dream, made a correct physical diagnosis of a brain tumor. I have yet to meet a medical student who has ever been told that in medical school. But I began to ask patients, what are you dreaming? And to do the drawings, and literally saw diagnoses as well as other things. And so it helped me to get more knowledge, also helped me to help them so that there wasn't conflict. You know, like my intuition says this is not good for me, but the doctor said I should have it. And, yeah, you go in conflict, you have more trouble. So I presented people with a list that psychiatrist George Solomon made up called immune-competent personality when he was working with AIDS patients before there was really any treatment for it. And if you hand this to people and say, okay, what are your answers? You know, it's expressing feelings, saying no if you don't want to do something, asking for help. I mean, then he said, this is a simple list, saves me a lot of trouble than, you know, 20 pages of psychological personality profiles. And it helps people look at themselves and know if this is a part of, you know, their makeup, especially expressing anger. Mm-hmm. I find that's a really vital thing, that you don't internalize it to make everybody else happy, but you express it. You know, what I call the righteous indignation or appropriate anger. Mm-hmm. You're not treated with respect in the hospital, you speak up. See, again, in the, I mean, medical errors are in the top 10 causes of death in this country. Mm-hmm. So you're a good patient, a nice submissive sufferer. You lie in your room and you let a mistake happen. If you're what I call a respondent, a responsible participant, you say, what are you doing? Who's that for? You know, I mean, you're a nuisance to everybody.
Right, right.
But you end up walking out of the hospital.
You're helping.
And I find some of the lists doctors make up after they get sick are, you have to laugh at it, you know, because they're all the things that I've been telling everybody. And then they write books saying, I want to apologize. This is literally a sentence in a book by a doctor whose wife died of cancer. I apologize to Dr. Siegel for what I used to think about him. Not that he ever caused me any trouble, but he said he's a big help. Yeah.
Which is very nice. How about, you know, what advice do you give to, for patients in terms of if they want to evolve, if they want to change, if they're sort of seeing it at a time of any of us? It doesn't have to be for a patient, any of us. But how do we make changes?
It, number one, see, I grew up with a mother when you say, Ma, I don't know what to do. Do what will make you happy. So she forced you to pay attention to feelings. Mm-hmm. Say, not where do you think you'll make more money, what, which college is better, what girl should go out. I mean, it didn't matter what you asked my mother. And I'd say people, well, to quote somebody who went from HIV negative to, positive to negative, if you live in your heart, magic happens. And I'd say that when you're making decisions about change, ask yourself, is this coming from my heart or my head? And when it's coming from your heart, yeah, you'll be doing good things for yourself. And it's, again, you're living your authentic life. The biblical line was, he who seeks to save his life will lose it. You please everybody else, you're in big trouble. And I think that's why teenagers commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And let me add that if anybody listening to this has a teenager, ask them, if they got a homework assignment at school, write a suicide note, write a love note, which is 3 to 5 times longer. And all the kids will tell you, suicide. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the tragic part. But when you, the next line was, he who's willing to lose his life will save it. But what you lose is the untrue self. I always say to people, eliminate what's killing you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So a lot of times I use their metaphors. See, if you have cancer and I say, what is it like to have this, the experience? The words that come out of people are about their life.
Like what?
Now, there is a group that will say it's a blessing, a wake-up call, a new beginning. Mm-hmm. Okay. Most will say failure, roadblock, sucking, draining. And when I say, how does failure fit your life? The woman said, oh, my parents committed suicide when I was a child. I must have been a failure as a child. See, what's sucking the life out of you? Mm-hmm. They look at you like, oh. And then they go home and they help heal their life. And as a rabbi said, sometimes a curse becomes a blessing. See, that's when the metaphor becomes it's a blessing. Well, one woman, the end of her poem said, I looked for an answer. It came, cancer. So, yeah. And I have to, what popped into my head, I have to share with you when you say make a change. This woman came in who had breast cancer and had a mastectomy. And she said, it's been a blessing. I had a mastectomy and a divorce. I gave you up a tit and an ass. And that's survival behavior, too, because I have a poem that says, if bilateral mastectomies can't be fun, they're not worth having. You know, it finishes with, it felt good to get that off my chest. I'm flat busted. I mean, you know, when you read that to an audience, yeah. And you see, just as you're laughing, you can't be afraid when you're laughing. I've learned that. Mm-hmm. And the American, Psychosomatic Association said that cancer patients with a sense of humor or who laughed even if there was nothing funny, you know, lived longer. So all these things make a difference.
I got to say, that was a wonderful, wonderful way to end the program. I think we should do this again. But I want to thank Dr. Bernie Siegel for joining us on Yale Cancer Center Answers. Thank you, Bernie.
All right.
Until next week, this is Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, you'll meet oncology nurses Judy Grasso and Marianne Davis.